Again, I appreciate everyone's willingness to be flexible on seating. The elders had asked on our Sunday meeting that we try to communicate our desire that we not spread out quite so much on Sunday nights and Wednesday nights. It's nice to need a big auditorium when we need it and to have it. It's also nice to not have to use all of it when we're less. So thank you very much for being able to move. I appreciate it. I'm sure we'll announce this several more times, but we finally have a Martinez baby. So that happened today, and James has the details, and I think it's in the, is it in the little sheet as well? Yeah, so it's in the little bulletin update, and I'm sure James will mention that later, but happy for Casey. And I've asked Bill Path if he would say a word of prayer before we get started, and then we'll pick up in Philippians 2 again. We were, in theory, finishing up verse 11 last week, but two things happened. I didn't get to one more slide I wanted before I was done, and we had a question from Rosalie that was a really good question that I botched entirely, and so tonight I'm going to come back to it, and we're going to start there. She had a question because she had a note either in her Bible or written in her Bible about the word for form in chapter 2. And I was under the delusion that it might be the word icon, which is the word for image of God in a lot of passages like Colossians. But it's not. That's not the word here. It's actually a more interesting word for the purpose of this. The term used here in the Greek text for form is morphe. There's a lot of English words that have some form of morph in it. And it describes the form as you would recognize it, okay? So I'm trying to think how to explain it. If you look at something and describe its attributes, you're describing its form, okay? So Jesus, according to Philippians 2, was in the form of God. So if you had a front row seat in heaven and you saw the person we're describing here, how would you describe him? You wouldn't describe him as a babe in a manger or as a human person. If you saw him prior to his incarnation in heaven, you wouldn't describe him as an angelic being. You wouldn't describe him as anything short of God. Okay? You would see him and say, this is nothing less than deity. That's what they saw. They saw the person on the throne and it was God. And that's what the text is telling us Jesus is. There are some commentaries that try to find a shortcut around that to make Jesus something less than God. And I just don't believe the text allows it. One of the reasons is because it uses this word. He is in the form God. If you beheld him, you would say, what's our English statement? It walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, right? Jesus had all the attributes of God. And so if you were to see him in that position, you would say, that's God. He emptied himself of that. And the text says he took on the form of a servant. So if you saw him before the incarnation, you would say, this is the king of the universe. If you saw him after the incarnation, you would say, this is a servant. And that's how Jesus frequently describes himself, like in Luke. I mentioned this passage, I think, last week, Luke 22. No, it was Sunday night when we were talking about deacons. I mentioned Luke 22, 26, and 27, where Jesus says, I am among you as one who serves. So if you look at Jesus in the flesh, you would not mistake him for God by looking at him. Okay? No one saw the babe in the manger and said, obviously it's God. No, I mean, it was a shock to even claim something like that, right? It looks like a baby in a manger. If you saw Jesus walking around Nazareth, you didn't confuse him with God. He looked like Jesus of Nazareth. Not only that, you didn't even confuse him with an important human, right? You didn't see him walking down the streets of Galilee and say, there goes Caesar, right? No, I mean, he looks like a very humble and boring human being. So he has the form of God, but then he takes the form of a servant. Okay, so that's the point the text seems to be making here about Jesus and who he is, that he takes on the form of a servant. That's the attributes he takes on, emptying himself of one to be the other. David. Yes, has more faith, yeah.
It says, in their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God.
Yeah, so the God of this world, in Corinthians, has blinded them to the morphe of Christ, the form of Christ. You should, now that Christ has been exalted, be able to look and say, that is our King. That's the Lord Jesus Christ. But what does the Lord of this world do? The Lord of this world pretends to be in charge, right? He is a usurper, a pretender on the throne. And so the powers in this world look like powerful lordship-like beings, right? And that's what Corinthians is saying. He has blinded you so that you don't recognize Jesus. You ought to be able to see the form of Jesus and know now that he's been exalted who he is. But you can't because you're blind. So think of all the things in this life that keep you from recognizing the lordship of Christ. They are all there to disguise, in Satan's benefit, his evil and to disguise Christ's glory and to make you think the one is the other instead. Questions on that term form and how it's being used here? I'm glad Rosalie brought it up. I had to go do some homework. I got a brand new book, and I got to try it out. It was a lot of fun. Yeah, it was great. Gerhard Schattel's Theological Dictionary of the New Testament has a whole page on it. Oh, that's great. And I got it for a dollar. That was the best part. OC's library sale, they clear out all their stuff that no one uses, like the reference books that I use. And so they had them all out for a dollar. And I thought, they had the whole set, but I couldn't figure out how to get this entire set. It's a 20-volume set of Cattell's dictionaries home, so I just bought the abridged version. But anyway, also explaining to Celine why I bought that many books is a little hard. One I could sneak in. The other thing I wanted to point out from verses 9 through 11 that we didn't get to talk about is that verses 9 through 11 is a quotation from the book of Isaiah. This is not even the only place it's made. I pointed out last week it's also quoted in Romans chapter 14, where it's stated in the indicative, every knee will bow, every tongue will confess. Here it says Jesus has been exalted, so every knee may or should bow, every tongue may or should confess. This is the passage that it comes from, and I've pointed this out before, but let me just go over it again. Isaiah 45 is the strongest chapter in, definitely in all the prophets, maybe in the entire Old Testament, talking about the fact that there is one God. Okay? So this is a passage looking forward to the Babylonian captivity, and they're thinking about, well, are we going to bow to Babylonian gods when we get there? And the text says, there is one God, there is one God, and it's almost redundant. I mean, it says it so many times, you want to throw up your hands and say, we get it already. And then Isaiah says it about 10 more times. Okay, so Isaiah 45, over and over again, there's one God, one God, one God, one God. And at the end of that chapter, verses 22 and 23 says this, turn to me and be saved, all the ends of the earth, for I am God and there is no other. By myself I have sworn. Why does God swear by himself? Because he is God and there is no other. If there was somebody else, he could swear by him. But there isn't anybody else. And so he swears by himself. From my mouth has gone out in righteousness a word that shall not return. And what does shall not return means? That he's... It's not going to come back to him having not accomplished its purpose. Sometimes I say, Lucas, sit down and be quiet and hold still. And those words are almost empty the moment they leave my mouth, right? And they just come right back to me. And his little six-year-old body continues to wiggle. And I have to say it 20 or 30 more times, right? Hold still, hold still, hold still, hold still, hold still, right? Because my words don't carry divine command. My powers of fatherhood are greatly overrated. So I can't issue an edict and immediately have it obeyed, much as I might like. Okay, so sometimes it takes me 7 or 8 edicts. God sends out his word and it does not come back. No one gives him any lip. No one says, are you sure about that? He says, my word goes out and it will not return to me. And what's the word? To me, every knee shall bow, every tongue shall swear allegiance. Okay? That's the passage Paul's quoting. Now, here's what's fundamentally interesting about this. And I cannot convey how significant it is. I'm going to try. Isaiah is saying, there is exactly one God. There is no other. And this is the unassailable fact, he says, that every knee will bow to that one God and every tongue will swear allegiance to him. Paul quotes that and says instead, Jesus. If Paul is wrong, that's blasphemy. See the point? To put anybody else's name in that place is blasphemy. Because there's one God, and this is not just happens to be a passage where it mentions it, this is the end of the most emphatic chapter in the Old Testament about the fact there's one God. And this is the fundamental claim of the one God, everyone will recognize me. That's how it says in the text. To me. Doesn't even say to God, does it? God is speaking, and he says, to me. And Paul simply says, that's what you're doing when you bow to Jesus. What is the unavoidable conclusion of that usage of that passage? Yeah, they are one and the same. To bow to Jesus is to bow to God. To confess Christ is to swear allegiance to the God of Israel. But they are one and the same. He is not a lesser God, a minor God, a kind of God, a sort of God. He is the one and only God. Now, as we mentioned last week, we now have to deal with the fairly complicated and confusing doctrine of the Trinity in Christianity. Paul doesn't. He just moves on. So he leaves us to figure that one out. How can it be one person and another person and they're the same person? And we don't have to deal with that tonight. But that's what's implicit in it. That this person, Jesus, is the same person as the God of Israel, not some other person, some other being. Interesting still, look in verse 11. This text said, every tongue shall swear allegiance to me, to God. Verse 11 says, every tongue shall confess that Jesus is Lord. Okay? This is the Greek term kurios, quite often used for Lord, benevolent Lord, a kind Lord, a loving Lord, but a powerful Lord. What's interesting about it is if you were reading in Isaiah 45 out of the Greek text, not the Hebrew, but the Greek text, it's the name God uses for himself. The Hebrews, remember, God has a name that the Hebrews were afraid to say. He says, I am that I am. I am has sent me unto you. Yahweh is the name they don't like to pronounce. And so in its place, when they came to that name, they'd say Adonai in Hebrew. When they came to Greek, they said, well, what's the Greek word for Adonai? Kurios. So in a text about there being one God, Paul quotes that verse, applies it to Jesus, and then says Jesus will be called Kurios, Adonai, Yahweh. The very name of God will be ascribed to Jesus. So again, not some other God. In the second century, Marcion the Heretic, which is a hint, he's going to be wrong. Known in history as Marcion the Heretic says, I think there must be two gods. There's an Old Testament God who doesn't like us very much, and there's a New Testament God who loves us in Jesus. Let's throw out the Old Testament and believe in the New Testament. They call him Marcion the Heretic for a reason, because that's not true. That's not what Paul is claiming, is it? He's not saying this is a new God who loves you and the old one didn't. The very same God, the very same name, the very same chapter. That's who you are swearing allegiance to when you confess that Jesus is Lord. So it's huge. Questions down through verse 11?
Not a question, just an observation.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I and the Father are one. To see me is to see the Father. Yeah.
This puts more emphasis on that incident. If I could talk.
Yeah. Right. Every so often, someone who wants to publish a book and make some money will write a book. The latest was Bart Ehrman, who wrote a book titled How Jesus Became God. And he claims that, well, Jesus didn't think he was God, and the apostles didn't think he was God, but the church, later on, three or four centuries down the road, finally decided Jesus was God. What do you see in these texts? Paul thinks he's God. He thinks Isaiah thinks he's God. He thinks Jesus thinks he's God. I mean, and Jesus, yeah, I mean, he makes it very clear that that's the claim being made. This is not something invented by the church centuries down the road. This is powerfully stated in the text. Okay. And that's probably one of my favorites. Love that passage. We're going to look at verses 12 through 18. Let's just start with the first two verses. There's plenty of there to chew on. If somebody wants to raise their hand and read verses 12 through 13. Bobby, thank you.
Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you both to will and to do.
Okay. This is a really fun little passage that does exactly what the Bible loves to do, to put two statements right next to each other that sound like they cannot possibly go together and connect them with the word and say, Christians have to believe this. And that's exactly what he does. First of all, notice that it's a command. He says, I want you to obey. You've been obeying when I'm there. You're going to obey when I'm not there. I want you to obey. So he's going to draw out a kind of life. And what is he basing this obedience on? The first word in verse 12 is therefore. Anybody ever hear the old preacher say, if you see a therefore, you're supposed to ask what it's there for? Yeah, there's a reason, right? So the therefore is telling you, look back at the prior verses. So he's taking the story of Christ he's been telling in verses 5 through 11 and says, and so, based on the story of Christ, his humiliation, and then his exaltation by God, what should we do? Here's how he's going to describe it. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. The first thing I have to note, I have to wag my finger at us a little bit. We quote this verse a lot in talking about how a person becomes a saved person. And I would just, for the sake of context, point out that's not the topic. Paul is talking to Christian people. Okay, he's not saying how to become a Christian. It might apply. I kind of think the general rule does, actually. But it's not what he's talking about. So just be careful before you quote that and say, well, you need to work out your own salvation and something else, right? Be careful when you say that, that he's talking to Christians. He's talking about you saved people need to continue to work out the consequence of your salvation. You have to act like saved people. He's not telling lost people to be saved. He's telling saved people to start acting like it. See the difference in those two? So just by way of emphasis, make sure that when we quote this passage that we keep it to where Paul's talking about. So when he says, work out your own salvation, I think this is an emphatically true statement that a Christian is going to act and behave and even obey in a way that reflects his salvation. God wants us to participate in salvation. There's two big extremes in the religious world, in the Christian world. You have kind of the Calvinist-Lutheran type point of view. You can't do anything to affect your salvation in any way. And then you have more of the Roman Catholic view. Do these things and you will be saved no matter what. Right? And Paul is neither. Right? What Paul says is, yes, if you are a saved person, there are things you're going to do. There are things you have to behave in a certain way. God wants you to participate. Okay? He's not doing it all for you. He wants you to participate. But then in verse 13, he says, "For it is God who works in you, both to will and to do, or to work for his good pleasure." So, are you responsible for all of it? Not only are you not responsible for all of it, you're barely responsible for what you do. Because it's God who is responsible. If you do something good, you don't even get credit for it. If you do something good, God gets credit for it because he's the one who taught you how to be good. When you do bad, you can take credit for that. That's all. You can take all the credit you want for sin. But what God says is, I want you to work out the implications of salvation, to start acting like saved people. And when you do, you still don't get credit. How do I know? Two statements. First of all, he says, the work Christians do is motivated by humility rather than ambition, which has been the point from verse 1 of chapter 2, right? Don't do anything for vainglory. Don't do anything for ambition. Do everything in humility. Esteem others better than yourself. And then he says, when you work out your salvation, do it in fear and trembling. Your conduct as a Christian is not a pompous behavior. It is a humble behavior. You have been asked to participate in the work of the Almighty God in your life. How's that for humbling? Okay. Have you ever been asked to do something that was way over your head? I mean, whether it's professionally or recreationally or whatever. Studying physics in college, there were some labs we did our junior year. We're about midway through. It became very obvious I had no idea what I was doing. And I was in a really good lab group, and we had some mechanical engineers who knew how to use the equipment, and I knew how to crunch the numbers and make the math work. And so somehow we survived with a B in junior lab, and we were very proud of that B, more proud of that B than any A we ever made, because we were in way over our head. But there was some fear and trembling when we went into the lab and started looking at this equipment, and it's expensive equipment. And we're not just using it, we're getting results that the real scientists are actually expecting to be able to use. They want to use our data. We're the lab rats. They're wanting to use our data to publish papers. And they're scared to death. Okay. In sophomore year, let me tell this story. Freshman year, you do really mediocre, unimportant labs in physics. And you use equipment that doesn't work. And you find out in sophomore year why the equipment doesn't work. The sophomores make the equipment. So in sophomore lab, you're building the equipment that the freshmen use. And of course none of it works because we're terrible at it. We're figuring it out as we go. But you feel really over your head. You're thinking, I'm building one of these? This has to have all this data ports that come in, and it's supposed to work, and I'm supposed to be able to program it? I don't know if I can do that. And you're way over your head. My senior year, I did a program working with a guy. He comes to me that summer and says, "Hey, Ben, we've got some software we need to run. But if we run this software on a regular computer, it'll take about 30 years to finish the first process. And we don't want to do that. So we've got a government grant, and we've rented some time on the supercomputer at NERSC. And it has, you know, however many hundred processors operating at once. So instead of 30 years, it'll take like 8 hours. Unfortunately, we have to rewrite the software so it will now work on this super, super, super computer. Ben, could you do that this summer?" What happens if Ben messes up? The money we spent to rent 8 hours at NERSC, which everyone in the entire planet would like to do, is wasted because the program didn't work. And you don't get it back. They don't reschedule. You go get another grant and you try again. I felt way over my head. Okay, so all those silly physics stories are to make this point. That's how we should feel when we are asked to participate in God's work in our lives. It's not about ambition and how great I am. I'm in way over my head. I'm supposed to be holy as he is holy, to imitate his son. With fear and trembling, I participate in God's work. So that's the first phrase that shows us God gets all the credit. The second one is when he says, that which is in you to will and to do. That's interesting. Not just the doing, even your intention to do, God gets the credit for that. Because you don't have a lot of good ideas. God had to show you how to want to obey. Okay? Without Jesus Christ doing what he does, without the Bible doing what it does, without the church doing what it does, do any of us even want to do what we're supposed to do? We have to be taught how to be selfless. See, the world teaches us to be selfish. Someone has to teach us how to be selfless. And it's Christ, it's His church, it's His word. And so when there is a will within us that wants to do selfless things, God says, that's me too. I get credit for that. It is God who works in you. Now, this is a challenging thought for a lot of us who probably would like to think, I'm inside here and God is out there. God says, I'm out there and I'm in here. He's responsible for all of it. There is no place you can hide from God if you want to. Okay. If I can steal, you know, my love affair with C.S. Lewis, so I just wanted to read this little line. This is his commentary. He doesn't write commentaries, but he had this little line on these two verses that I thought was especially good. Here, the first half is, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, which looks as if everything depended on us and our good actions. But the second half goes on, for it is God who works in you, which looks as if God did everything and we nothing. I am afraid that is the sort of thing we come up against in Christianity. I am puzzled, but I am not surprised. You see, we are now trying to understand and to separate into watertight compartments what exactly God does and what man does when God and man are working together. We begin by thinking it is like two men working together so that you could say, he did this bit and I did that. But this way of thinking breaks down. God is not like that. He is inside you as well as outside. Even if we could understand who did what, I do not think human language could properly express it. So I think that's a pretty good position on these two verses, that Paul says, on the one hand, yes, you are completely responsible. Work out your own salvation. And then on the other hand, he turns right around and says, and you get to take no credit for it. Do it with absolute humility. And it was God from start to finish who helped you do it. And both of those things are true at the same time. And it's the very kind of thing Christianity is asking us to believe on a regular basis. So the way I explain it is what I just said. I think Calvinism has it wrong, where Calvin says you're a depraved, wicked, terrible person. You can't do anything good if you wanted to, and God has to kind of compel you to do good. I don't think that's what Paul's saying, but I do think he's saying you wouldn't be doing good if God hadn't showed you how. And so God gets the credit for all the good you do. Even your desire to do good, you learned from God. Rosalie, yes. Yeah, that's the meaning of work it out. It's not, as I said before, it's not talking to lost people to become saved. He's talking to saved people, and he's saying, bring it to completion, right? You have put on Christ, now bring that, work it out to its completion through the behavior that he's describing here. And then make sure you do it humbly. So think again, as I keep saying, I really believe a lot of this has to do with what's going to come up in chapter 4. There's a dispute in Philippi between Euodia and Syntyche. You have two godly people who are arguing about good work they're doing. And what does Paul say? He says, you need to do good work. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Does that leave room for any fighting and bickering? When you're afraid, you're in over your head, you don't bicker with anybody who wants to help. You get along. And then you realize, Euodia and Syntyche, you don't even get to take credit for what you did. Well, which one of us is the most important in the church of Philippi? Neither of you. Neither of you get any credit for what you did. Because even your best intentions are the result of God's guidance. See, humbling statements here about how to view the way we do good. So yes, do good. Just don't think that doing good makes you do it good. If we're good, it's because God made us good. Questions down through verse 13? Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're trying to help out. Because work out, I mean, it's not immediately clear what work out means. But you're right. It has the idea of bringing it to its conclusion. Continue to do something. It's not a one-time action, Paul saying, here, do this. He's saying, work this out. Figure it out. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yep, take it to the end. Okay, verses 14 through 18. Somebody like to read the next paragraph? Yes, Yvonne, 14 through 18.
All things without grumbling or disputing, so that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent children of God, above reproach in the midst of a forbidden perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights to the world, holding fast the word of life, so that
Thank you. So, what is the first practical command that Paul says comes out of working out your salvation with fear and trembling and God working in you? Don't grumble and complain. That surprises us. Doctrinally speaking, I mean, if I'm making a list, what's the first thing on my list of things Christians need to do to work out, bring to conclusion their salvation? Of course, it's going to depend on the situation, right? If you're currently robbing a grocery store, I'm going to tell you the first thing you need to do to work out your salvation is to stop doing that. And so the church of Philippi, they were grumbling and complaining. So what's the first thing he says they need to do? He says, stop doing that. Stop grumbling and complaining. Can we elaborate? What things are we not to grumble and complain about? Or which things? Yeah, those are good examples. What's the word that Paul uses? Yeah, all, every. Yeah, so all your examples, I think, is what he has in mind. You're exactly right. But what Paul says is everything. If you're grumbling about it, stop. That's one of the things. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. It is, in fact, a positive statement. It's not a prohibition, thou shalt not complain. It's a statement to do, and then an explanation of how the doing is to be done. So work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Do all the things a Christian does without grumbling and complaining. So think of it this way. Think of those as parallel. A really good way to think about it. The grumbling and complaining goes, the fear and trembling takes their place. That's the proper attitude for obedience. The other one is not. So do all things without grumbling. The ESV says, or questioning. I would be careful with that word. I don't think it means you can't have questions. I don't think it means you should not be inquisitive. But I do believe that the text there is telling about the kind of questioning that is accusatory, that is pejorative, that is aimed at tearing down. Do we sometimes ask questions not with the goal of getting information, but with the goal of making somebody look bad? I do. I mean, I assume everyone else does too. I'm not supposed to, but I assume we all do. Why are we doing that? Don't you know we should? Right? Those are questions that are not usually aimed at information. Those are usually aimed at making a point. And so I think that's why the ESV renders that questioning. It's the accusatory question, the question that says, I already know the answer to this, and I'm here to make a point. Here's my question, kind of question. Be very careful with those. So without grumbling or questioning, what's the result of laying aside grumbling or complaining? Verse 15, blameless and innocent. The first word scares me as much as the second word. Let's talk about blameless. If you are grumbling and complaining about the work of the church, who's to blame that the church is not what it should be? This text says you are at least partly to blame. You are not blameless. Which is funny because that's usually why we grumble and complain. We grumble and complain to assign blame. Paul says, but if you are grumbling and complaining, you are not blameless. You bear part of the responsibility. My father tells the story of O.C. Greenhall that I've told here before, and it was one of Dad's first preaching jobs, little tiny country town in Arkansas, and O.C. Greenhall was a member there and was an old-timer, been there a long time, and every new idea that Dad came up with, O.C. Greenhall had a reason why it would fail. This church didn't meet on Sunday nights. Dad said, wouldn't it be nice if we met on Sunday nights? We could have a second sermon. It'd be great. Won't work. Nobody will come. When they found out it wasn't going to work, it was because Dad and O.C. Greenhall were the only ones there. Okay, they wanted to put gravel on the gravel parking lot so that you know they didn't have to mow it quite as much. And Dad says, let's bring in some gravel, cover the parking lot, and see if we can kill out some of this grass. Not going to work, O.C. Greenhall. Who was there that Saturday to spread the gravel? Dad and O.C. Greenhall. Okay. So there is a way to have concerns and be supportive of the work at the same time. So if you're going to be that person, make sure you're not to blame for its failure. O.C. Greenhall honestly and sincerely believed everything would fail, but it was never going to be his fault. It would not be for lack of trying. Okay, and that's, I think, a lesson to be learned. More often what we do is we grumble and complain as a way to excuse ourselves and to assign blame to somebody else. So you're going to be blameless if you don't grumble and complain, and innocent. Do you see how it's connected to the word blame? Right? You are guilty. If the church is not what it should be, and you're one of the people who grumble about it, you are not innocent of the failure. You are guilty of what it should be. You are guilty of that shortcoming. This is tough language. And it's made tougher by the fact that it follows verses 12 and 13. This is what it means to work out your salvation. If you want to bring your salvation to its conclusion, this is the kind of work we have to be doing. In innocence and blamelessness, blameless and innocent children of God. You ever done a project with children, like your kids? Lucas and I put something together once in a while, especially around Christmas. We'll buy something, you know, that for mom or whatever. We're going to put it together. And how much help do you suppose Lucas is in putting anything together? Well, you can do the math on that. For every screw he puts in, he loses five. You know, it's we know how that works. Is he ever negative about it? He is a delight. Is he ever disinterested? No. He wants to be there. He wants to do everything, including things he can't do. That delight of a child who wants to help is what Paul says the children of God should look like. Not the grumbling, complaining, they say it'll fail. The people who sometimes trip and fall and hurt ourselves, but in the process, always are there, innocent and blameless, always trying to be the people working it out. Working out and bringing to fruition the salvation that's in Christ. And we do that without blemish. See these words? Let's get that again. Blameless, innocent, now without blemish. So part of Christianity is keeping yourself away from sin, the moral stain of sin. What does Paul say? Even if you're doing good things, but you do them with grumbling, complaining, and these attitudes he's describing, he says you're not blameless, you're not innocent, you're not without blemish. Your good has been blemished. It's still good, but it's blemished. Compare this to chapter 1, where he talked about people who were preaching Christ out of ambition. He says, I'm glad they're preaching Christ, but is that blemished because of their bad attitudes? Yeah, I think it's the same idea here. David, you had a hand up.
Peter addresses this in chapter 4, 1 Peter also.
Okay, read that for us.
8 and 9, above all things have perfect love for one another, for love will cover a multitude of sins. Be hospitable to one another without grumbling. The whole deal is here, if you have love for one another, you're not going to be grumbling and complaining.
Yep.
So yep. I think it relates very well to the passage in Philippians.
Yep.
Because to be a Christian, to work out your salvation with fear and trembling, means you're going to have compassion and love for your brothers and sisters.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely right. When we do that, we are showing the world the distinguishing characteristic of Christianity, which Paul describes here as humility, right? That what they see in Christians working is different. When you see people working in the world, what are they working for? Working to get ahead, working to get a paycheck, working to become president, right? Whatever's going on, they're working to accomplish something, right, for themselves. He says, but here we are shining a light into a twisted and crooked generation, a world that doesn't understand is seeing a whole different way of living and doing things in the humility of Christians. The light we hold forth is the gospel of Christ. That's verse 16. So we're shining as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life. So the day of Christ, I may be proud, but I did not run in vain or labor in vain. There's a personal note he slides in there. First, we hold forth the gospel of Jesus, not our own ambitions, right? What lights the way? What tells us what we're doing next? What advances the gospel of Christ? What can I do in humility in Christ? That's what shows me what comes next. Okay, not what gets me furthest. But then he says, this makes me very proud, which is funny. It's funny to me in a paragraph about humility, Paul says, I'm very proud of you. So maybe he thinks it's funny too, I don't know. But he looks at them and he says, it feels good to know that these Philippians could get it right, that the day of Christ would come, that he could find this Philippian church there doing what they're supposed to be doing. And there's Paul in prison, and he could say, good job, Paul. Right? That you taught them something right. You showed them how to do it right. They worked out their salvation with fear and trembling. Okay, so that seems to be the point. Bobby, are you scratching your head? Or okay, you got your hand up.
Both.
Okay.
It's very similar to what he says in Romans 12, almost the same type of analogy. Present your body as a living sacrifice. That's what we need to be.
Yeah.
Acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. What we should be doing as we work out, like you said, make sure our life is in control by God. And then he goes and says, how? Don't conform to the world. Don't conform to this perverse generation that you're talking about here. Renew your mind. Prove what is God's acceptable will. That it's not the complaining, the grumbling.
Yeah.
Doing the things that, again, as you work out that salvation, that are God-like things.
Yep. Yep. That's exactly right. Just 5 minutes left, so let me just wrap up this paragraph. Paul himself is going to continue this behavior in verse 17. Even if I am to be poured out as a drink offering. It's a shame we didn't all grow up as first century Jewish people, and we could really understand some of Paul's language. So he's talking about the drink offering that you'd pour out on the altar, and there's this vivid image in his mind of this liquid being poured over the altar. Okay? And he says, that's what's about to happen to me. I am going to be poured out. What's in the cup after it's been poured out? Okay? He is going to be empty. Coaches use the phrase, leave it all out in the field, right? Or you know, don't take any back home with you. You want to put all of yourself into whatever we're doing. And that's Paul's description of his life as a Christian. I am pouring myself out. He's going to be used up. That's the Christian goal. Have you ever thought about that? Your goal as a Christian is to live in such a way that at whatever time you die, you had nothing left. That whenever that time comes, you had nothing left to give. You had poured it all out. You weren't trying to take anything with you, because you can't. Got news for you. You weren't trying to take anything with you. You weren't trying to hold it back for days ahead. You were poured out. You had spent every resource, every energy, every moment that God had given you. You had just poured it out in his service. Paul says, I'm about to. Even if I am poured out. Does Paul know whether or not he's going to survive this imprisonment? He does, but he doesn't know it. He thinks he might. We talked about that in chapter 1, but he's not certain. Even if I'm poured out. He's quite confident that he can be happy about it. Now, that's different. The worldly view of life is you are a success if you get to the end of life and you have lots. Paul says, I will be happy if I get to the end of life and I am empty. That's how I can rejoice. That I can know I have done and given all that I can for the cause of Christ. And he says, you Philippians are the proof of that. That even in prison, I'm helping you out. That's the joy that he looks forward to. And in verse 18, you also should be glad and rejoice with me. How could we be glad and rejoice with Paul? I'd have to pour myself out. So, going back, I keep bringing this up because I think it's important. If I'm Euodia and Syntyche and I'm fighting about, I'm using some of my energy, instead of doing good with it, I'm using some of it to complain about the other people and each other. But I'm not pouring myself out. I'm using some of it wastefully. I'm trying to accumulate prestige in the church and show how important I am. He says, you need to rejoice with me. And the way you rejoice with Paul is through humility when you pour it all out. Okay. What's going to happen then in the next? Let me just kind of give you a quick outline of what's following. So chapter 2, he gives you the story of Jesus and says, this is our model of humility. The second half of chapter 2, he's going to give you two more examples, Timothy and Epaphroditus. So these are two men who have worked with Paul, who the Philippians knew, and he says, let me give you another good example of how you should be behaving. Act like this. Then in chapter 3, he's going to say, let me give you one more example, and it's Paul himself. Chapter 3, the first half is all about Paul. Let me show you what I have been doing. In Notice he gives himself as the example last. He doesn't say, I'm the perfect example. Oh, yeah, and there's Jesus. No, he starts with Jesus, then talks with his fellow laborers, Timothy and Epaphroditus, and then finally he says, and now I can tell you about myself. And the big grand finale then in chapter 4 will be, now get along, quit fighting, act like these people. So next week, Lord willing, verses 19 through 30, we'll talk about Timothy and Epaphroditus, and they'll each get about a paragraph describing their labors. This is some of the most information we'll get about, this is all the information we'll get about Epaphroditus, and quite a lot of what we get about Timothy comes from this. So it'll be interesting if you have any, even a passing interest in two figures who aren't on the list of the most notable New Testament characters. What were the other Christians doing? What about Timothy and Epaphroditus? Paul's going to say, you know Timothy and Epaphroditus, don't you? Well, no, I don't, but I'm going to find out next week. Thanks for your attention.